The second broadsheet stated that our headquarters were at Vyazma, that Count Wittgenstein had defeated the French, but that as many of the inhabitants of Moscow wished to be armed, weapons were ready for them at the arsenal, sabers, pistols, and muskets, which could be had at a low price. The tone of the proclamation was not as jocose as in the former Chigirin talks. Pierre pondered over these broadsheets. Evidently the terrible storm cloud he had desired with the whole strength of his soul, but which yet aroused involuntary horror in him, was drawing near. "Shall I join the army and enter the service, or wait?" he asked himself for the 100th time. He took a pack of cards that lay on the table and began to lay them out for a game of patience. "If this patience comes out," he said to himself, after shuffling the cards, holding them in his hand and lifting his head, "if it comes out, it means... what does it mean?" He had not decided what it should mean when he heard the voice of the eldest princess at the door asking whether she might come in. "Then it will mean that I must go to the army," said Pierre to himself. "Come in, come in," he added to the princess. Only the eldest princess, the one with the stony face and long waist, was still living in Pierre's house. The two younger ones had both married. "Excuse my coming to you, cousin," she said in a reproachful and agitated voice. "You know, some decision must be come to. What is going to happen? Everyone has left Moscow, and the people are rioting. How is it that we are staying on?" "On the contrary, things seem satisfactory, ma cousine," said Pierre in the bantering tone he habitually adopted toward her, always feeling uncomfortable in the role of her benefactor. "Satisfactory indeed. Very satisfactory. Barbara Ivanovna told me today how our troops are distinguishing themselves. It certainly does them credit. And the people, too, are quite mutinous. They no longer obey. Even my maid has taken to being rude. At this rate, they will soon begin beating us. One can't walk in the streets. But above all, the French will be here any day now, so what are we waiting for? I ask just one thing of you, cousin," she went on. "Arrange for me to be taken to Petersburg. Whatever I may be, I can't live under Bonaparte's rule." "Oh, come, ma cousine, where do you get your information from? On the contrary, I won't submit to your Napoleon. Others may if they please. If you don't want to do this, but I will, I'll give the order at once." The princess was apparently vexed at not having anyone to be angry with. Muttering to herself, she sat down on a chair. "But you've been misinformed," said Pierre. "Everything is quiet in the city, and there is not the slightest danger. See, I've just been reading." He showed her the broadsheet. "Count Rostopchin writes that he will stake his life on it that the enemy will not enter Moscow." "Oh, that count of yours," said the princess malevolently. "He is a hypocrite, a rascal who has himself roused the people to riot. Didn't he write in those idiotic broadsheets that anyone, whoever it might be, should be dragged to the lock-up by his hair? How silly! And honor and glory to whoever captures him," he says. "This is what his cajolery has brought us to. Barbara Ivanovna told me the mob nearly killed her because she said something in French." "Oh, but it's so... you take everything so to heart," said Pierre, and began laying out his cards for patience. Although that patience did come out, Pierre did not join the army, but remained in deserted Moscow, ever in the same state of agitation, irresolution, and alarm, yet at the same time joyfully expecting something terrible. Next day, toward evening, the princess set off, and Pierre's head steward came to inform him that the money needed for the equipment of his regiment could not be found without selling one of the estates. In general, the head steward made out to Pierre that his project of raising a regiment would ruin him. Pierre listened to him, scarcely able to repress a smile. "Well, then, sell it," said he. "What's to be done? I can't draw back now." The worse everything became, especially his own affairs, the better was Pierre pleased, and the more evident was it that the catastrophe he accepted was approaching. Hardly anyone he knew was left in town. Julie had gone, and so had Princess Mary. Of his intimate friends, only the Rostovs remained, but he did not go to see them. To distract his thoughts, he drove that day to the village of Vorontsovo to see the great balloon Leppich was constructing to destroy the foe, and a trial balloon that was to go up next day. The balloon was not yet ready, but Pierre learned that it was being constructed by the emperor's desire. The emperor had written to Count Rostopchin as follows: "As soon as Leppich is ready, get together a crew of reliable and intelligent men for his car, and send a courier to General Kutuzov to let him know. I have informed him of the matter. Please impress upon Leppich to be very careful where he descends for the first time, that he may not make a mistake and fall into the enemy's hands. It is essential for him to combine his movements with those of the commander-in-chief." On his way home from Vorontsovo, as he was passing the Bolotnoye place, Pierre, seeing a large crowd round the Lobnoye place, stopped and got out of his trap. A French cook, accused of being a spy, was being flogged. The flogging was only just over, and the executioner was releasing from the flogging bench a stout man with red whiskers, in blue stockings and a green jacket, who was moaning piteously. Another criminal, thin and pale, stood near. Judging by their faces, they were both Frenchmen. With a frightened and suffering look resembling that on the thin Frenchman's face, Pierre pushed his way in through the crowd. "What is it? Who is it? What is it for?" he kept asking. But the attention of the crowd, officials, burghers, shopkeepers, peasants, and women in cloaks and in pelisses, was so eagerly centered on what was passing in Lobnoye Place that no one answered him. The stout man rose, frowned, shrugged his shoulders, and, evidently trying to appear firm, began to pull on his jacket without looking about him. But suddenly his lips trembled, and he began to cry, in the way full-blooded grown-up men cry, though angry with himself for doing so. In the crowd, people began talking loudly to stifle their feelings of pity, as it seemed to Pierre. "He's cooked as some prince. Hey, monsieur, Russian sauce seems to be sour to a Frenchman. Sets his teeth on edge," said a wrinkled clerk who was standing behind Pierre when the Frenchman began to cry. The clerk glanced round, evidently hoping that his joke would be appreciated. Some people began to laugh. Others continued to watch in dismay the executioner who was undressing the other man. Pierre choked, his face puckered, and he turned hastily away, went back to his trap, muttering something to himself as he went, and took his seat. As they drove along, he shuddered and exclaimed several times so audibly that the coachman asked him, "What is your pleasure?" "Where are you going?" shouted Pierre to the man who was driving to Lubyanka Street. "To the governor's, as you ordered," answered the coachman. "Fool, idiot!" shouted Pierre, abusing his coachman, a thing he rarely did. "Home, I told you, and drive faster, blockhead." "I must get away this very day," he murmured to himself. At the sight of the tortured Frenchman and the crowd surrounding the Lobnoye place, Pierre had so definitely made up his mind that he could no longer remain in Moscow and would leave for the army that very day, that it seemed to him that either he had told the coachman this, or that the man ought to have known it for himself. On reaching home, Pierre gave orders to Evstafi, his head coachman, who knew everything, could do anything, and was known to all Moscow, that he would leave that night for the army at Mozhaisk, and that his saddle horses should be sent there. This could not all be arranged that day, so on Evstafi's representation, Pierre had to put off his departure till next day to allow time for the relay horses to be sent on in advance. On the 24th, the weather cleared up after a spell of rain, and after dinner Pierre left Moscow. When changing horses that night in Perhushkovo, he learned that there had been a great battle that evening. This was the Battle of Shevardino. He was told that there in Perhushkovo the earth trembled from the firing, but nobody could answer his questions as to who had won. At dawn next day, Pierre was approaching Mozhaisk. Every house in Mozhaisk had soldiers quartered in it, and at the hostel where Pierre was met by his groom and coachman, there was no room to be had. It was full of officers. Everywhere in Mozhaisk and beyond it, Troops were stationed or on the march. Cossacks, foot and horse soldiers, wagons, caissons, and cannon were everywhere. Pierre pushed forward as fast as he could, and the farther he left Moscow behind, and the deeper he plunged into that sea of troops, the more was he overcome by restless agitation and a new and joyful feeling he had not experienced before. It was a feeling akin to what he had felt at the Sloboda Palace during the Emperor's visit, a sense of the necessity of undertaking something and sacrificing something. He now experienced a glad consciousness that everything that constitutes men's happiness, the comforts of life, wealth, even life itself, is rubbish it is pleasant to throw away compared with something. With what? Pierre could not say, and he did not try to determine for whom and for what he felt such particular delight in sacrificing everything. He was not occupied with the question of what to sacrifice for. The fact of sacrificing in itself afforded him a new and joyous sensation. Chapter 19. Senselessness of the Battle of Borodino and erroneousness of the historians' accounts of it. Where and how it was fought. On the 24th of August, the Battle of the Shevardino Redoubt was fought. On the 25th, not a shot was fired by either side. And on the 26th, the Battle of Borodino itself took place. Why and how were the battles of Shevardino and Borodino given and accepted? Why was the Battle of Borodino fought? There was not the least sense in it for either the French or the Russians. Its immediate result for the Russians was, and was bound to be, that we were brought nearer to the destruction of Moscow, which we feared more than anything in the world. And for the French, its immediate result was that they were brought nearer to the destruction of their whole army, which they feared more than anything in the world. What the result must be was quite obvious. And yet Napoleon offered, and Kutuzov accepted that battle. If the commanders had been guided by reason, it would seem that it must have been obvious to Napoleon that by advancing 1,300 miles and giving battle with a probability of losing a quarter of his army, he was advancing to certain destruction. And it must have been equally clear to Kutuzov that by accepting battle and risking the loss of a quarter of his army, he would certainly lose Moscow. For Kutuzov, this was mathematically clear, as it is that if when playing draughts I have one man less and go on exchanging, I shall certainly lose, and therefore should not exchange. When my opponent has 16 men and I have 14, I'm only 1/8 weaker than he. But when I have exchanged 13 more men, he will be 3 times as strong as I am. Before the Battle of Borodino, our strength in proportion to the French was about as 5 to 6, but after that battle, it was little more than 1 to 2. Previously, we had 100,000 against 120,000. Afterwards, little more than 50,000 against 100,000. Yet the shrewd and experienced Kutuzov accepted the battle, while Napoleon, who was said to be a commander of genius, gave it, losing a quarter of his army, and lengthening his lines of communication still more. If it is said that he expected to end the campaign by occupying Moscow, as he had ended a previous campaign by occupying Vienna, there is much evidence to the contrary. Napoleon's historians themselves tell us that from Smolensk onwards he wished to stop, knew the danger of his extended position, and knew that the occupation of Moscow would not be the end of the campaign. For he had seen at Smolensk the state in which Russian towns were left to him, and had not received a single reply to his repeated announcements of his wish to negotiate. In giving and accepting battle at Borodino, Kutuzov acted involuntarily and irrationally. But later on, to fit what had occurred, the historians provided cunningly devised evidence of the foresight and genius of the generals, who, of all the blind tools of history, were the most enslaved and involuntary. The ancients have left us model heroic poems in which the heroes furnish the whole interest of the story. and we're still unable to accustom ourselves to the fact that for our epoch, histories of that kind are meaningless. On the other question, how the Battle of Borodino and the preceding Battle of Shevardino were fought, there also exists a definite and well-known but quite false conception. All the historians describe the affair as follows. The Russian army, they say, in its retreat from Smolensk, sought out for itself the best position for a general engagement and found such a position at Borodino. The Russians, they say, fortified this position in advance on the left of the high road from Moscow to Smolensk and almost at a right angle to it from Borodino to Utitsa, at the very place where the battle was fought. In front of this position, they say, a fortified outpost was set up on the Shevardino mound to observe the enemy. On the 24th, we are told, Napoleon attacked this advanced post and took it, and on the 26th attacked the whole Russian army, which was in position on the field of Borodino. So the histories say. And it is all quite wrong, as anyone who cares to look into the matter can easily convince himself. The Russians did not seek out the best position, but on the contrary, during the retreat, passed many positions better than Borodino. They did not stop at any one of these positions because Kutuzov did not wish to occupy a position he had not himself chosen, because the popular demand for a battle had not yet expressed itself strongly enough, and because Miloradovich had not yet arrived with the militia, and for many other reasons. The fact is that other positions they had passed were stronger, and that the position at Borodino, the one where the battle was fought, far from being strong, was no more a position than any other spot one might find in the Russian Empire by sticking a pin into the map at hazard. Not only did the Russians not fortify the position on the field of Borodino to the left of and at a right angle to the high road, that is, the position in which the battle took place, but never till the 25th of August 1812 did they think that a battle might be fought there. This was shown, first, by the fact that there were no entrenchments there by the 25th, and that those begun on the 25th and 26th were not completed, and secondly, by the position of the Shevardino redoubt. That redoubt was quite senseless in front of the position where the battle was accepted. Why was it more strongly fortified than any other post? And why were all efforts exhausted and 6,000 men sacrificed to defend it till late at night on the 24th? A Cossack patrol would have sufficed to observe the enemy. Thirdly, as proof that the position on which the battle was fought had not been foreseen and that the Shevardino redoubt was not an advanced post of that position, we have the fact that up to the 25th, Barclay de Tolly and Bagration were convinced that the Shevardino redoubt was the left flank of the position, and that Kutuzov himself, in his report, written in hot haste after the battle, speaks of the Shevardino redoubt as the left flank of the position. It was much later, when reports on the Battle of Borodino were written at leisure, that the incorrect and extraordinary statement was invented, probably to justify the mistakes of a commander-in-chief who had to be represented as infallible, that the Shevardino redoubt was an advanced post, whereas in reality it was simply a fortified point on the left flank, and that the Battle of Borodino was fought by us on an entrenched position previously selected, whereas it was fought on a quite unexpected spot, which was almost unentrenched. The case was evidently this. A position was selected along the river Kolocha, which crosses the high road not at a right angle but at an acute angle, so that the left flank was at Shevardino, the right flank near the village of Novoye, and the center at Borodino, at the confluence of the rivers Kolocha and Voina. To anyone who looks at the field of Borodino without thinking of how the battle was actually fought, this position, protected by the river Kolocha, presents itself as obvious for an army whose object was to prevent an enemy from advancing along the Smolensk road to Moscow. Napoleon, riding to Valuyevo on the 24th, did not see, as the history books say he did, the position of the Russians from Utitsa to Borodino. He could not have seen that position because it did not exist. Nor did he see an advanced post of the Russian army. But while pursuing the Russian rearguard, he came upon the left flank of the Russian position at the Shevardino Redoubt, and, unexpectedly for the Russians, moved his army across the Kolocha. And the Russians, not having time to begin a general engagement, withdrew their left wing from the position they had intended to occupy and took up a new position which had not been foreseen and was not fortified. By crossing to the other side of the Kolocha, to the left of the high road, Napoleon shifted the whole forthcoming battle from right to left, looking from the Russian side, and transferred it to the plain between Utitsa, Semyonovsk, and Borodino, a plain no more advantageous as a position than any other plain in Russia. And there the whole battle of the 26th of August took place. Had Napoleon not ridden out on the evening of the 24th to the Kolocha, and had he not then ordered an immediate attack on the redoubt, but had begun the attack next morning, no one would have doubted that the Shevardino Redoubt was the left flank of our position, and the battle would have taken place where we expected it. In that case, we should probably have defended the Shevardino Redoubt, our left flank, still more obstinately. We should have attacked Napoleon in the center or on the right, and the engagement would have taken place on the 25th, in the position we intended and had fortified. But as the attack on our left flank took place in the evening after the retreat of our rear guard, that is, immediately after the fight at Grudnyovo, and as the Russian commanders did not wish or were not in time to begin a general engagement then on the evening of the 24th, the first and chief action of the Battle of Borodino was already lost on the 24th and obviously led to the loss of the one fort on the 26th. After the loss of the Shevardino Redoubt, we found ourselves on the morning of the 25th without a position for our left flank and were forced to bend it back and hastily entrench it where it chanced to be. Not only was the Russian army on the 26th defended by weak, unfinished entrenchments, but the disadvantage of that position was increased by the fact that the Russian commanders, not having fully realized what had happened, namely the loss of our position on the left flank and the shifting of the whole field of the forthcoming battle from right to left, maintained their extended position from the village of Novoye to Utitsa, and consequently had to move their forces from right to left during the battle. So it happened that throughout the whole battle, the Russians opposed the entire French army launched against our left flank with but half as many men. Poniatowski's action against Utitsa and Uvarov's on the right flank against the French were actions distinct from the main course of the battle. So the Battle of Borodino did not take place at all, as in an effort to conceal our commander's mistakes even at the cost of diminishing the glory due to the Russian army and people, it has been described. The Battle of Borodino was not fought on a chosen and entrenched position with forces only slightly weaker than those of the enemy, but, as a result of the loss of the Shevardino Redoubt, the Russians fought the Battle of Borodino on an open and almost unentrenched position with forces only half as numerous as the French. That is to say, under conditions in which it was not merely unthinkable to fight for 10 hours and secure an indecisive result, but unthinkable to keep an army even from complete disintegration and flight. Chapter 20. Pierre encounters cavalry advancing and carts of wounded retiring. He talks to an army doctor. Pierre looks for the position occupied by the army. Peasant militia digging entrenchments. On the morning of the 25th, Pierre was leaving Mozhaisk. At the descent of the high, steep hill, down which a winding road led out of the town past the cathedral on the right, where a service was being held and the bells were ringing, Pierre got out of his vehicle and proceeded on foot. Behind him, a cavalry regiment was coming down the hill, preceded by its singers. Coming up toward him was a train of carts carrying men who had been wounded in the engagement the day before. The peasant drivers shouting and lashing their horses, kept crossing from side to side. The carts, in each of which 3 or 4 wounded soldiers were lying or sitting, jolted over the stones that had been thrown on the steep incline to make it something like a road. The wounded, bandaged with rags, with pale cheeks, compressed lips, and knitted brows, held on to the sides of the carts as they were jolted against one another. Almost all of them stared with naive, childlike curiosity at Pierre's white hat and green swallowtail coat. Pierre's coachman shouted angrily at the convoy of wounded to keep to one side of the road. The cavalry regiment, as it descended the hill with its singers, surrounded Pierre's carriage and blocked the road. Pierre stopped, being pressed against the side of the cutting in which the road ran. The sunshine from behind the hill did not penetrate into the cutting, and there it was cold and damp. But above Pierre's head was the bright August sunshine, and the bells sounded merrily. One of the carts with wounded stopped by the side of the road close to Pierre. The driver in his bast shoes ran panting up to it, placed a stone under one of its tireless hind wheels, and began arranging the breech band on his little horse. One of the wounded, an old soldier with a bandaged arm, who was following the cart on foot, caught hold of it with his sound hand and turned to look at Pierre. "I say, fellow countrymen, will they set us down here or take us on to Moscow?" he asked. Pierre was so deep in thought that he did not hear the question. He was looking now at the cavalry regiment that had met the convoy of wounded, now at the cart by which he was standing, in which 2 wounded men were sitting and 1 was lying. One of those sitting up in the cart had probably been wounded in the cheek. His whole head was wrapped in rags, and 1 cheek was swollen to the size of a baby's head. His nose and mouth were twisted to 1 side. This soldier was looking at the cathedral and crossing himself. Another, a young lad, a fair-haired recruit as white as though there were no blood in his thin face, looked at Pierre kindly with a fixed smile. The third lay prone so that his face was not visible. The cavalry singers were passing close by. "Ah, lost, quite lost, is my head so keen, living in a foreign land," they sang their soldiers' dance song. As if responding to them, but with a different sort of merriment, the metallic sound of the bells reverberated high above, and the hot rays of the sun bathed the top of the opposite slope with yet another sort of merriment. But beneath the slope, by the cart with the wounded, near the panting little nag where Pierre stood, it was damp, sober, and sad. The soldier with the swollen cheek looked angrily at the cavalry singers. "Oh, the coxcombs," he muttered reproachfully. "It's not the soldiers only, but I've seen peasants today, too. The peasants, even they have to go," said the soldier behind the cart, addressing Pierre with a sad smile. "No distinctions made nowadays. They want the whole nation to fall on them. In a word, it's Moscow. They want to make an end of it." In spite of the obscurity of the soldier's words, Pierre understood what he wanted to say and nodded approval. The road was clear again. Pierre descended the hill and drove on. He kept looking to either side of the road for familiar faces, but only saw everywhere the unfamiliar faces of various military men of different branches of the service, who all looked with astonishment at his white hat and green tailcoat. Having gone nearly 3 miles, he at last met an acquaintance and eagerly addressed him. This was one of the head army doctors. He was driving toward Pierre in a covered gig, sitting beside a young surgeon, and on recognizing Pierre, he told the Cossack who occupied the driver's seat to pull up.
"Count, Your Excellency, how come you to be here?" asked the doctor.
"Well, you know, I wanted to see..."
"Yes, yes, there will be something to see."
Pierre got out and talked to the doctor, explaining his intention of taking part in a battle. The doctor advised him to apply direct to Kutuzov.
"Why should you be God knows where out of sight during the battle?" he said, exchanging glances with his young companion. "Anyhow, His Serene Highness knows you and will receive you graciously. That's what you must do."
The doctor seemed tired and in a hurry. You think so?
I also wanted to ask you where our position is exactly, said Pierre.
The position? Repeated the doctor.
That's not my line. Drive past Tatarinova. A lot of digging is going on there. Go up the hillock and you'll see.
Can one see from there? If you would... But the doctor interrupted him and moved toward his gig.
I would go with you, but on my honor, I'm up to here. And he pointed to his throat. I'm galloping to the commander of the corps. How do matters stand?
You know, Count, there'll be a battle tomorrow. Out of an army of 100,000, we must expect at least 20,000 wounded, and we haven't stretchers or bunks or dressers or doctors enough for 6,000. We have 10,000 carts, but we need other things as well. We must manage as best we can.
The strange thought that of the thousands of men, young and old, who had stared with merry surprise at his hat, perhaps the very men he had noticed, 20,000 were inevitably doomed to wounds and death, amazed Pierre. They may die tomorrow. Why are they thinking of anything but death? And by some latent sequence of thought, the descent of the Mozhaisk Hill, the carts with the wounded, the ringing bells, the slanting rays of the sun, and the songs of the cavalrymen vividly recurred to his mind. A cavalry ride to battle and meet the wounded, and do not for a moment think of what awaits them, but pass by, winking at the wounded. Yet from among these men, 20,000 are doomed to die. And they wonder at my hat. Strange, thought Pierre, continuing his way to Tatarinova. In front of a landowner's house to the left of the road stood carriages, wagons, and crowds of orderlies and sentinels. The commander-in-chief was putting up there, but just when Pierre arrived, he was not in, and hardly any of his staff were there. They had gone to the church service. Pierre drove on toward Gorky. When he had ascended the hill and reached the little village street, he saw for the first time peasant militiamen in their white shirts and with crosses on their caps, who, talking and laughing loudly, animated and perspiring, were at work on a huge knoll overgrown with grass to the right of the road. Some of them were digging, others were wheeling barrow loads of earth along planks, while others stood about doing nothing. Two officers were standing on the knoll directing the men. On seeing these peasants, who were evidently still amused by the novelty of their position as soldiers, Pierre once more thought of the wounded men at Mozhaisk, and understood what the soldier had meant when he said, "They want the whole nation to fall on them." The sight of these bearded peasants at work on the battlefield, with their queer clumsy boots and perspiring necks, and their shirts opening from the left toward the middle, unfastened, exposing their sunburned collarbones, impressed Pierre more strongly with the solemnity and importance of the moment than anything he had yet seen or heard. Chapter 21. Pierre ascends a knoll at Gorky, surveys the scene, and inquires as to the position occupied. A procession carrying the Smolensk Mother of God, the reverence of the crowd and of Kutuzov. Pierre stepped out of his carriage, and passing the toiling militiamen, ascended the knoll, from which, according to the doctor, the battlefield could be seen. It was about 11 o'clock. The sun shone somewhat to the left and behind him, and brightly lit up the enormous panorama which, rising like an amphitheater, extended before him in the clear, rarefied atmosphere. From above on the left, bisecting that amphitheater, wound the Smolensk High Road, passing through a village with a white church, some 500 paces in front of the knoll and below it. This was Borodino. Below the village, the road crossed the river by a bridge, and winding down and up, rose higher and higher to the village of Valuyevo, visible about 4 miles away, where Napoleon was then stationed. Beyond Valuyevo, the road disappeared into a yellowing forest on the horizon. Far in the distance in that birch and fir forest to the right of the road, the cross and belfry of the Kolochar Monastery gleamed in the sun. Here and there, over the whole of that blue expanse, to right and left of the forest and the road, smoking campfires could be seen, and indefinite masses of troops, ours and the enemy's. The ground to the right, along the course of the Kolocha and Moskva rivers, was broken and hilly. Between the hollows, the villages of Bezubova and Zakharino showed in the distance. On the left, the ground was more level. There were fields of grain, and the smoking ruins of Semyonovsk, which had been burned down, could be seen. All that Pierre saw was so indefinite that neither the left nor the right side of the field fully satisfied his expectations. Nowhere could he see the battlefield he had expected to find, but only fields, meadows, troops, woods, the smoke of campfires, villages, mounds, and streams. And try as he would, he could descry no military position in this place which teemed with life, nor could he even distinguish our troops from the enemy's. "I must ask someone who knows," he thought, and addressed an officer who was looking with curiosity at his huge, unmilitary figure. "May I ask you," said Pierre, "what village that is in front?" "Bud, you know, isn't it?" said the officer, turning to his companion. "Borodino," the other corrected him. The officer, evidently glad of an opportunity for a talk, moved up to Pierre. "Are those our men there?" Pierre inquired. "Yes, and there further on are the French," said the officer. "There they are, there. You can see them." "Where? Where?" asked Pierre. "One can see them with the naked eye. Why, there." The officer pointed with his hand to the smoke visible on the left beyond the river, and the same stern and serious expression that Pierre had noticed on many of the faces he had met came into his face. "Ah, so those are the French," said Pierre. "And over there?" He pointed to a knoll on the left near which some troops could be seen. "Those are ours," said the officer. "Ah, ours. And there?" Pierre pointed to another knoll in the distance with a big tree on it, near a village that lay in a hollow, where also some campfires were smoking, and something black was visible. "That's his again," said the officer. It was the Shevardino Redoubt. "It was ours yesterday, but now it is his." "Then how about our position?" "Our position?" replied the officer with a smile of satisfaction. "I can tell you quite clearly, because I constructed nearly all our entrenchments. There, you see? There's our center, at Borodino, just there." And he pointed to the village in front of them with a white church. "That's where one crosses the Kolocha. You see down there where the rows of hay are lying in the hollow? There's the bridge. That's our center. Our right flank is over there." He pointed sharply to the right, far away in the broken ground. "That's where the Moskva River is, and we've thrown up three redoubts there, very strong ones. The left flank..." Here the officer paused. "Well, you see, that's difficult to explain. Yesterday our left flank was there at Shevardino. You see where the oak is? But now we've withdrawn our left wing. Now it's over there. Do you see that village in the smoke? That's Semyonovsk. Yes, there." He pointed to Raevsky's knoll. "But the battle will hardly be there. His having moved his troops there is only a ruse. He will probably pass round to the right of the Moskva. But wherever it may be, many a man will be missing tomorrow," he remarked. An elderly sergeant who had approached the officer while he was giving these explanations had waited in silence for him to finish speaking, but at this point, evidently not liking the officer's remark, interrupted him. "Gabions must be sent for," said he sternly. The officer appeared abashed, as though he understood that one might think of how many men would be missing tomorrow, but ought not to speak of it. "Well, send number 3 company again," the officer replied hurriedly. "And you, are you one of the doctors?" "No, I've come on my own," answered Pierre, and he went down the hill again, passing the militiamen. "Oh, those damn fellows," muttered the officer who followed him, holding his nose as he ran past the men at work. "There they are, bringing her, coming. There they are. They'll be here in a minute," voices were suddenly heard saying, and officers, soldiers, and militiamen began running forward along the road. A church procession was coming up the hill from Borodino. First, along the dusty road came the infantry in ranks, bareheaded and with arms reversed. From behind them came the sound of church singing. Soldiers and militiamen ran bareheaded past Pierre toward the procession.
"They're bringing her, our protectress, the Iberian Mother of God," someone cried.
"The Smolensk Mother of God," another corrected him. The militiamen, both those who had been in the village and those who had been at work on the battery, threw down their spades and ran to meet the church procession. Following the battalion that marched along the dusty road came priests in their vestments, one little old man in a hood with attendants and singers. Behind them, soldiers and officers bore a large, dark-faced icon with an embossed metal cover. This was the icon that had been brought from Smolensk and had since accompanied the army. Behind, before, and on both sides, crowds of militiamen with bared heads walked, ran, and bowed to the ground. At the summit of the hill, they stopped with the icon. The men who had been holding it up by the linen bands attached to it were relieved by others. The chanters relit their censers, and service began. The hot rays of the sun beat down vertically, and a fresh soft wind played with the hair of the bared heads and with the ribbons decorating the icon. The singing did not sound loud under the open sky. An immense crowd of bareheaded officers, soldiers, and militiamen surrounded the icon. Behind the priest and the chanter stood the notabilities on a spot reserved for them. A bald general with a St. George's cross on his neck stood just behind the priest's back, and without crossing himself, he was evidently a German, patiently awaited the end of the service, which he considered it necessary to hear to the end, probably to arouse the patriotism of the Russian people. Another general stood in a martial pose, crossing himself by shaking his hand in front of his chest while looking about him. Standing among the crowd of peasants, Pierre recognized several acquaintances among these notables, but did not look at them. His whole attention was absorbed in watching the serious expression on the faces of the crowd of soldiers and militiamen, who were all gazing eagerly at the icon. As soon as the tired chanters, who were singing the service for the 20th time that day, began lazily and mechanically to sing, "Save from calamity thy servants, O Mother of God," and the priest and deacon chimed in, "For to thee under God we all flee, as to an inviolable bulwark and protection," there again kindled in all those faces the same expression of consciousness of the solemnity of the impending moment that Pierre had seen on the faces at the foot of the hill at Mozhaisk, and momentarily on many and many faces he had met that morning, and heads were bowed more frequently, and hair tossed back, and sighs and the sound men made as they crossed themselves were heard. The crowd round the icon suddenly parted and pressed against Pierre. Someone, a very important personage, judging by the haste with which way was made for him, was approaching the icon. It was Kutuzov, who had been riding round the position, and on his way back to Tatarinova, had stopped where the service was being held. Pierre recognized him at once by his peculiar figure, which distinguished him from everybody else. With a long overcoat on his exceedingly stout, round-shouldered body, with uncovered white head and puffy face showing the white ball of the eye he had lost, Kutuzov walked with plunging, swaying gait into the crowd and stopped behind the priest. He crossed himself with an accustomed movement, bent till he touched the ground with his hand, and bowed his white head with a deep sigh. Behind Kutuzov was Bennigsen and the suite. Despite the presence of the commander-in-chief, who attracted the attention of all the superior officers, the militiamen and soldiers continued their prayers without looking at him. When the service was over, Kutuzov stepped up to the icon, sank heavily to his knees, bowed to the ground, and for a long time tried vainly to rise, but could not do so on account of his weakness and weight. His white head twitched with the effort. At last he rose, kissed the icon as a child does with naively pouting lips, and again bowed till he touched the ground with his hand. The other generals followed his example, then the officers, and after them
with excited faces, pressing on one another, crowding, panting, and pushing, scrambled the soldiers and militiamen. Chapter 22. Boris meets Pierre. Dolokhov makes his way to Kutuzov. Kutuzov notices Pierre. Dolokhov asks Pierre to be reconciled. Staggering amid the crush, Pierre looked about him.
Count Peter Kirillovich, how did you get here? Said a voice.
Pierre looked round. Boris Drubetskoy, brushing his knees with his hand, he had probably soiled them when he too had knelt before the icon, came up to him smiling. Boris was elegantly dressed, with a slightly martial touch appropriate to a campaign. He wore a long coat, and like Kutuzov, had a whip slung across his shoulder. Meanwhile, Kutuzov had reached the village and seated himself in the shade of the nearest house, on a bench which one Cossack had run to fetch and another had hastily covered with a rug. An immense and brilliant suite surrounded him. The icon was carried further, accompanied by the throng. Pierre stopped some 30 paces from Kutuzov, talking to Boris. He explained his wish to be present at the battle and to see the position. "This is what you must do," said Boris. "I will do the honors of the camp to you. You will see everything best from where Count Bennigsen will be. I'm in attendance on him, you know. I'll mention it to him. But if you want to ride round the position, come along with us. We're just going to the left flank. Then, when we get back, do spend the night with me, and we'll arrange a game of cards. Of course, you know Dmitri Sergeyevich. Those are his quarters." And he pointed to the third house in the village of Gorky. "But I should like to see the right flank. They say it's very strong," said Pierre. "I should like to start from the Moskva River and ride round the whole position."
"Well, you can do that later, but the chief thing is the left flank."
"Yes, yes, but where is Prince Bolkonski's regiment? Can you point it out to me?"
"Prince Andrew's? We shall pass it, and I'll take you to him."
"What about the left flank?" asked Pierre.
"Well, to tell you the truth, between ourselves, God only knows what state our left flank is in," said Boris, confidentially lowering his voice. "It is not at all what Count Bennigsen intended. He meant to fortify that knoll quite differently, but..." Boris shrugged his shoulders. "His Serene Highness would not have it, or someone persuaded him. You see..." But Boris did not finish, for at that moment Kaisarov, Kutuzov's adjutant, came up to Pierre.
"Ah, Kaisarov," said Boris, addressing him with an unembarrassed smile. "I was just trying to explain our position to the Count. It is amazing how His Serene Highness could so foresee the intentions of the French."
"You mean the left flank?" asked Kaisarov.
"Yes, exactly. The left flank is now extremely strong." Though Kutuzov had dismissed all unnecessary men from the staff, Boris had contrived to remain at headquarters after the changes. He had established himself with Count Bennigsen, who, like all on whom Boris had been in attendance, considered young Prince Drubetskoy an invaluable man. In the higher command, there were two sharply defined parties, Kutuzov's party and that of Bennigsen, the chief of staff. Boris belonged to the latter, and no one else, while showing servile respect to Kutuzov, could so create an impression that the old fellow was not much good and that Bennigsen managed everything. Now the decisive moment of battle had come, when Kutuzov would be destroyed and the power passed to Bennigsen. Or even if Kutuzov won the battle, it would be felt that everything was done by Bennigsen. In any case, many great rewards would have to be given for tomorrow's action, and new men would come to the front. So Boris was full of nervous vivacity all that day. After Kaisarov, others whom Pierre knew came up to him, and he had not time to reply to all the questions about Moscow that were showered upon him, or to listen to all that was told him. The faces all expressed animation and apprehension. But it seemed to Pierre that the cause of the excitement shown in some of these faces lay chiefly in questions of personal success. His mind, however, was occupied by the different expression he saw on other faces, an expression that spoke not of personal matters, but of the universal questions of life and death. Kutuzov noticed Pierre's figure and the group gathered round him.
"Call him to me," said Kutuzov.
An adjutant told Pierre of His Serene Highness's wish, and Pierre went toward Kutuzov's bench. But a militiaman got there before him. It was Dolokhov.
"How did that fellow get here?" asked Pierre. He's a creature that wriggles in anywhere, was the answer. He's been degraded, you know. Now he wants to bob up again. He's been proposing some scheme or other and has crawled into the enemy's picket line at night. He's a brave fellow. Pierre took off his hat and bowed respectfully to Kutuzov. I concluded that if I reported to your Serene Highness, you might send me away or say that you knew what I was reporting, but then I shouldn't lose anything, Dolokhov was saying. Yes, yes. But if I were right, I should be rendering a service to my fatherland, for which I am ready to die. Yes, yes. And should your Serene Highness require a man who will not spare his skin, please think of me. Perhaps I may prove useful to your Serene Highness. Yes, yes, Kutuzov repeated, his laughing eye narrowing more and more as he looked at Pierre. Just then, Boris, with his courtier-like adroitness, stepped up to Pierre's side near Kutuzov, and in a most natural manner, without raising his voice, said to Pierre, as though continuing an interrupted conversation, The militia have put on clean white shirts to be ready to die. What heroism, Count? Boris evidently said this to Pierre in order to be overheard by his Serene Highness. He knew Kutuzov's attention would be caught by those words. And so it was. What are you saying about the militia? He asked Boris. Preparing for tomorrow, your Serene Highness. For death. They've put on clean shirts. A wonderful, a matchless people, said Kutuzov, and he closed his eyes and swayed his head. A matchless people, he repeated with a sigh. So you want to smell gunpowder? He said to Pierre. Yes, it's a pleasant smell. I have the honor to be one of your wife's adorers. Is she well? My quarters are at your service. And as often happens with old people, Kutuzov began looking about absent-mindedly, as if forgetting all he wanted to say or do. Then, evidently remembering what he wanted, he beckoned to Andrew Kaisarov, his adjutant's brother. Those verses, those verses of Marian's, how do they go, eh? Those he wrote about Gerakov, lectures for the corps indicting. Recite them, said he, evidently preparing to laugh. Kaisarov recited. Kutuzov smilingly nodded his head to the rhythm of the verses. When Pierre had left Kutuzov, Dolokhov came up to him and took his hand. I'm very glad to meet you here, Count, he said aloud, regardless of the presence of strangers, and in a particularly resolute and solemn tone. On the eve of a day when God alone knows who of us is fated to survive, I'm glad of this opportunity to tell you that I regret the misunderstandings that occurred between us, and should wish you not to have any ill feeling for me. I beg you to forgive me. Pierre looked at Dolokhov with a smile, not knowing what to say to him. With tears in his eyes, Dolokhov embraced Pierre and kissed him. Boris said a few words to his general, and Count Bennigsen turned to Pierre and proposed that he should ride with him along the line. It will interest you, said he. Yes, very much, replied Pierre. Half an hour later, Kutuzov left for Tatarinova, and Bennigsen and his suite, with Pierre among them, set out on their ride along the line. Chapter 23. Pierre rides to the left flank with Bennigsen, who explains the position in a way Pierre does not understand, and changes one of Kutuzov's dispositions. From Gorky, Bennigsen descended the high road to the bridge, which, when they had looked at it from the hill, the officer had pointed out as being the center of our position, and where rows of fragrant new-mown hay lay by the riverside. They rode across that bridge into the village of Borodino, and thence turned to the left, passing an enormous number of troops and guns, and came to a high knoll where militiamen were digging. This was the redoubt, as yet unnamed, which afterwards became known as the Raevsky Redoubt, or the Knoll Battery. But Pierre paid no special attention to it. He did not know that it would become more memorable to him than any other spot on the plain of Borodino. They then crossed the hollow to Semyonovsk, where the soldiers were dragging away the last logs from the huts and barns. Then they rode downhill and uphill, across a rye field trodden and beaten down as if by hail, following a track freshly made by the artillery over the furrows of the ploughed land, and reached some fleshes which were still being dug. At the fleshes, Bennigsen stopped and began looking at the Shevardino redoubt opposite, which had been ours the day before, and where several horsemen could be described. The officers said that either Napoleon or Murat was there, and they all gazed eagerly at this little group of horsemen. Pierre also looked at them, trying to guess which of the scarcely discernible figures was Napoleon. At last, those mounted men rode away from the mound and disappeared. Bennigsen spoke to a general who approached him and began explaining the whole position of our troops. Pierre listened to him, straining each faculty to understand the essential points of the impending battle, but was mortified to feel that his mental capacity was inadequate for the task. He could make nothing of it. Bennigsen stopped speaking, and noticing that Pierre was listening, suddenly said to him, "I don't think this interests you." "On the contrary, it's very interesting," replied Pierre, not quite truthfully. From the fleshes, they rode still farther to the left along a road winding through a thick, low-growing birch wood. In the middle of the wood, a brown hare with white feet sprang out, and, scared by the tramp of the many horses, grew so confused that it leaped along the road in front of them for some time, arousing general attention and laughter, and only when several voices shouted at it did it dart to one side and disappear in the thicket. After going through the wood for about a mile and a half, they came out on a glade where troops of Tuchkov's corps were stationed to defend the left flank. Here at the extreme left flank, Bennigsen talked a great deal and with much heat, and, as it seemed to Pierre, gave orders of great military importance. In front of Tuchkov's troops was some high ground not occupied by troops. Bennigsen loudly criticized this mistake, saying that it was madness to leave a height which commanded the country around unoccupied, and to place troops below it. Some of the generals expressed the same opinion. One in particular declared with martial heat that they were put there to be slaughtered. Bennigsen, on his own authority, ordered the troops to occupy the high ground. This disposition on the left flank increased Pierre's doubt of his own capacity to understand military matters. Listening to Bennigsen and the generals criticizing the position of the troops behind the hill, he quite understood them and shared their opinion. But for that very reason, he could not understand how the man who put them there behind the hill could have made so gross and palpable a blunder. Pierre did not know that these troops were not, as Bennigsen supposed, put there to defend the position, but were in a concealed position as an ambush, that they should not be seen, and might be able to strike an approaching enemy unexpectedly. Bennigsen did not know this, and moved the troops forward according to his own ideas, without mentioning the matter to the commander-in-chief. Chapter 24. Prince Andrew's Reflections on Life and Death. Pierre comes to see him. On that bright evening of August 25th, Prince Andrew lay leaning on his elbow in a broken-down shed in the village of Knyazkovo, at the further end of his regiment's encampment. Through a gap in the broken wall he could see, beside the wooden fence, a row of 30-year-old birches with their lower branches lopped off, a field on which shocks of oats were standing, and some bushes near which rose the smoke of campfires, the soldiers' kitchens. Narrow and burdensome and useless to anyone as his life now seemed to him, Prince Andrew, on the eve of battle, felt agitated and irritable, as he had done 7 years before at Austerlitz. He had received and given the orders for next day's battle, and had nothing more to do. But his thoughts, the simplest, clearest, and therefore most terrible thoughts, would give him no peace. He knew that tomorrow's battle would be the most terrible of all he had taken part in, and for the first time in his life, the possibility of death presented itself to him. Not in relation to any worldly matter, or with reference to its effect on others, but simply in relation to himself, to his own soul. Vividly, plainly, terribly, and almost as a certainty. And from the height of this perception, all that had previously tormented and preoccupied him suddenly became illumined by a cold white light without shadows, without perspective, and without distinction of outline. All life appeared to him like magic lantern pictures at which he had long been gazing by artificial light through a glass.
Now he suddenly saw those badly daubed pictures in clear daylight and without a glass. Yes, yes. There they are, those false images that agitated and raptured and tormented me, said he to himself, passing in review the principal pictures of the magic lantern of life and regarding them now in the cold white daylight of his clear perception of death. There they are, those rudely painted figures that once seemed splendid and mysterious. Glory, the good of society, love of a woman, the fatherland itself. How important these pictures appeared to me, with what profound meaning they seemed to be filled. And it is all so simple, pale, and crude in the cold white light of this morning which I feel is dawning for me. The three great sorrows of his life held his attention in particular: his love for a woman, his father's death, and the French invasion which had overrun half Russia. Love, that little girl who seemed to me brimming over with mystic forces. Yes, indeed, I loved her. I made romantic plans of love and happiness with her. Oh, what a boy I was, he said aloud bitterly. Ah, me, I believed in some ideal love which was to keep her faithful to me for the whole year of my absence. Like the gentle dove in the fable, she was to pine apart from me. But it was much simpler, really. It was all very simple and horrible. When my father built Bald Hills, he thought the place was his land, his air, his peasants. But Napoleon came and swept him aside, unconscious of his existence, as he might brush a chip from his path, and his Bald Hills and his whole life fell to pieces. Princess Mary says it is a trial sent from above. What is the trial for, when he is not here and will never return? He is not here. For whom, then, is the trial intended? The fatherland, the destruction of Moscow. And tomorrow I shall be killed. Perhaps not even by a Frenchman, but by one of our own men. By a soldier discharging a musket close to my ear, as one of them did yesterday. And the French will come and take me by the head and heels and fling me into a hole that I may not stink under their noses. And new conditions of life will arise which will seem quite ordinary to others, and about which I shall know nothing. I shall not exist. He looked at the row of birches shining in the sunshine, with their motionless green and yellow foliage and white bark. To die, to be killed tomorrow. That I should not exist. That all this should still be, but no me. And the birches with their light and shade, the curly clouds, the smoke of the campfires, and all that was around him, changed and seemed terrible and menacing. A cold shiver ran down his spine. He rose quickly, went out of the shed, and began to walk about. After Prince Andrew had returned to the shed, voices were heard outside. "Who's that?" he cried. The red-nosed Captain Timochin, formerly Dolokhov's squadron commander, but now from lack of officers a battalion commander, shyly entered the shed, followed by an adjutant and the regimental paymaster. Prince Andrew rose hastily, listened to the business they had come about, gave them some further instructions, and was about to dismiss them when he heard a familiar lisping voice behind the shed.
"Devil take it," said the voice of a man stumbling over something.
Prince Andrew looked out of the shed and saw Pierre, who had tripped over a pole on the ground and had nearly fallen, coming his way. It was unpleasant to Prince Andrew to meet people of his own set in general, and Pierre especially, for he reminded him of all the painful moments of his last visit to Moscow.
"You? What a surprise," said he. "What brings you here? This is unexpected."
As he said this, his eyes and face expressed more than coldness. They expressed hostility, which Pierre noticed at once. He had approached the shed full of animation, but on seeing Prince Andrew's face, he felt constrained and ill at ease.
I've come simply, you know, come. It interests me, said Pierre, who had so often that day senselessly repeated the word interesting.
I wish to see the battle.
Oh, yes.
And what do the Masonic brothers say about war? How would they stop it? Said Prince Andrew sarcastically.
Well, and how's Moscow?
And my people, have they reached Moscow at last? He asked seriously.
Yes, they have. Julie Drubetskaya told me so. I went to see them, but missed them. They've gone to your estate near Moscow.
Chapter 25. Timohin's opinion of Kutuzov. Prince Andrew on Barclay de Tolly. War and chess. The spirit of the army. Voltzogen and Clausewitz. The war must be extended widely. Pierre understands the importance of this war. Not take prisoners. What is war? Prince Andrew thinks of Natasha. The officers were about to take leave, but Prince Andrew, apparently reluctant to be left alone with his friend, asked them to stay and have tea. Seats were brought in, and so was the tea. The officers gazed with surprise at Pierre's huge, stout figure and listened to his talk of Moscow and the position of our army round which he had ridden. Prince Andrew remained silent, and his expression was so forbidding that Pierre addressed his remarks chiefly to Timohin, the good-natured battalion commander.
So you understand the whole position of our troops? Prince Andrew interrupted him.
Yes. That is, how do you mean? Said Pierre. Not being a military man, I can't say I've understood it fully, but I understand the general position.
Well, then you know more than anyone else, be it who it may, said Prince Andrew.
Oh, said Pierre, looking over his spectacles in perplexity at Prince Andrew.
Well, and what do you think of Kutuzov's appointment? He asked.
I was very glad of his appointment, that's all I know, replied Prince Andrew.
And tell me your opinion of Barclay de Tolly. In Moscow, they're saying heaven knows what about him. What do you think of him?
Ask them, replied Prince Andrew, indicating the officers. Pierre looked at Timohin with the condescendingly interrogative smile with which everybody involuntarily addressed that officer.
We see light again since His Serenity has been appointed, Your Excellency, said Timohin timidly, and continually turning to glance at his colonel.
Why so? Asked Pierre.
Well, to mention only firewood and fodder, let me inform you. Why, when we were retreating from Svensiani, we dare not touch a stick or a wisp of hay or anything. You see, we were going away, so he, the enemy was always he to the Russians, so he would get it all. Wasn't it so, Your Excellency?
And again Timohin turned to the prince.
But we daren't. In our regiment, two officers were court-martialed for that kind of thing. But when His Serenity took command, everything became straightforward. Now we see light.
Then why was it forbidden? Timohin looked about in confusion, not knowing what or how to answer such a question. Pierre put the same question to Prince Andrew.
Why, so as not to lay waste the country we were abandoning to the enemy, said Prince Andrew with venomous irony. It is very sound. One can't permit the land to be pillaged and accustom the troops to marauding. At Smolensk, too, he judged correctly that the French might outflank us, as they had larger forces. But he could not understand this, cried Prince Andrew in a shrill voice that seemed to escape him involuntarily. He could not understand that there, for the first time, we were fighting for Russian soil, and that there was a spirit in the men such as I had never seen before, that we had held the French for 2 days, and that that success had increased our strength tenfold. He ordered us to retreat, and all our efforts and losses went for nothing. He had no thought of betraying us. He tried to do the best he could. He thought out everything, and that is why he is unsuitable. He is unsuitable now just because he plans out everything very thoroughly and accurately, as every German has to. How can I explain? Well, say your father has a German valet, and he's a splendid valet and satisfies your father's requirements better than you could. Then it's all right to let him serve.
But if your father is mortally sick, you'll send the valet away and attend to your father with your own unpracticed, awkward hands, and will soothe him better than a skilled man who was a stranger could. So it has been with Barclay. While Russia was well, a foreigner could serve her and be a splendid minister. But as soon as she's in danger, she needs one of her own kin. But in your club, they've been making him out a traitor. They slander him as a traitor. And the only result will be that afterwards, ashamed of their false accusations, they will make him out a hero or a genius instead of a traitor. And that will be still more unjust. He is an honest and very punctilious German.
And they say he's a skillful commander, rejoined Pierre.
I don't understand what is meant by a skillful commander, replied Prince Andrew ironically.
A skillful commander? Replied Pierre. Why, one who foresees all contingencies and foresees the adversary's intentions.
But that's impossible, said Prince Andrew, as if it were a matter settled long ago.
Pierre looked at him in surprise.
And yet they say that war is like a game of chess, he remarked.
Yes, replied Prince Andrew,
but with this little difference. That in chess you may think over each move as long as you please and are not limited for time. And with this difference, too, that a knight is always stronger than a pawn, and two pawns are always stronger than one, while in war a battalion is sometimes stronger than a division and sometimes weaker than a company. The relative strength of bodies of troops can never be known to anyone. Believe me, he went on, if things depended on arrangements made by the staff, I should be there making arrangements. But instead of that, I have the honor to serve here in the regiment with these gentlemen, and I consider that on us tomorrow's battle will depend and not on those others. Success never depends and never will depend on position or equipment or even on numbers, and least of all on position.
But on what then?
On the feeling that is in me and in him. He pointed to Timochin. And in each soldier.
Prince Andrew glanced at Timochin, who looked at his commander in alarm and bewilderment.